Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church Podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
So we're continuing our series on Foretold, and we're looking into the Old Testament and seeing that as we look into the Old Testament, how the Old Testament was pointing us all along to Jesus. And so what I'm going to be doing today is there's been a little bit of a challenge for me this week, and it's been taking this book of Zechariah in the Old Testament and finding a way to unpack it for you in one morning. And so we're going to be here for the next 3 hours so that I can get all this done. I'm kidding. I won't do that to you because I love you, and I think God has a plan for your life. Zechariah. As I was studying this week, it was really interesting. Old Testament scholars had pointed out that aside from the book of Isaiah, Zechariah is the most quoted of the prophets in the New Testament. Mentioned in the Gospels about 40 times. And when you look at the book of Revelation, also there. If you look throughout the New Testament, you have the book of Zechariah mentioned or quoted around 70 times. Isn't that amazing? The interesting thing is that most people don't talk about the book of Zechariah. So here you have one of the most important of the Old Testament, all of it's important, but you have one of the most important of Old Testament texts that's rarely taught, but it's one of the most influential in the New Testament in terms of how it is that we see Jesus. Zechariah, he came from a priestly family. His father was named Edo. This almost sounds like Star Wars, doesn't it? Which, by the way, is coming out in the not-too-distant future. My girls and I are going to be going and seeing it because you have to finish the series, right? But he came from a priestly family. He's described as a visionary. He worked along with a prophet Haggai. Some of you have heard of the prophet Haggai. Well, the thing that was confronting the people was the temple had been destroyed, and they were in a time where they were trying to rebuild the temple. Reestablish the place of God's worship, the supremacy of God in worship. And of course, with Haggai, he had a certain approach. Haggai was the type of coach, if you think about in terms of coaches, that choose the players out so that he can get the most out of them. Did any of you have a coach like that if you played sports? Can I see your hands? I had some of those, but I also had some of the other coaches that would kind of come alongside me. They would walk alongside me, and they said, look, Jeremy, look, here's why you're not getting the job done, right? You didn't execute the play well. They took a little bit of a different approach. Zechariah took a little bit of a different approach. Rather than being in their face and jumping on them about the building of the temple, Zechariah was the prophet that says it's important, but motivated them in a different way. Zechariah's name means God remembers. God remembers. And when you think in the time, you imagine being a people where, you know, you've been displaced, you're trying to come back, you're trying to rebuild a temple for the Lord, and it's not going well. It's frustrating, and the people are frustrated. In fact, they're not just frustrated, they struggle with continuing the motivation to complete what it is, the task that God had given them to do. But God remembers. See, God remembers his promise, and he also knows how he's going to fulfill them. This whole story of the book of Zechariah is set when the Israelites are returning from Babylon, no doubt from vacation. Just kidding. They were under Babylonian oppression. Haggai and Zechariah, they're motivating the people to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple. Jeremiah, who I was named after, said years before that the Israelites would be in captivity for 70 years, and God had promised that they would be restored and that God would bring about a new temple. And God even promised that he would bring a Messiah that was going to rule over all of the nations. In the book of Zechariah, there are 8 visions that Zechariah has. It reminded me of this Christmas season of Ebenezer Scrooge. Does anybody remember this guy? This is George C. Scott. I think he actually played the role of Ebenezer Scrooge better than anybody, at least of those that have played Scrooge. We can debate that after church is over with, if you like. But he played this role phenomenally well. You remember that he has a spirit that comes to him, and the spirit says, you know, tonight you're going to be visited by 3 ghosts. And you have the ghost of Christmas past, the ghost of Christmas present, and the ghost of Christmas future. And the ghost of Christmas future is creepy, isn't he? Well, it all happens in one night. And the reason I bring this up is because this is a lot like what happens to Zechariah. Zechariah is not having really what we would call a dream, where he's like in a sleep state and out of it. Instead, he's having more of what we would call a vision, where he is totally aware of what's happening in front of him, just like Ebenezer Scrooge was totally aware. Remember, it's like Scrooge was living these events again as he would go into the past, or he's living these events again and what had happened recently in his life, or he was jumping ahead into the future a little bit and he was seeing things, right? Well, this is what was happening to Zechariah. He was getting visions. And the visions are paired together. And so what I have the small task of doing is explaining those visions to you this morning so that you can see why it's important. Are you ready for them? Let's go. All right. So if you look, you have the first and the eighth visions are actually paired together. At least scholars pair them together. And you find these visions in Zechariah chapter 1, starting in verse 8. And you see the eighth vision in Zechariah chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. Now, the good news is you can just take a picture of this. And now that I'm looking at the picture, those are some creepy people. But what you see in the first and the eighth vision is there are four horsemen that are on patrol. And the four horsemen represents God's watch over all of the nations. The report is that the world will be at peace. And God, in this time, had raised up Persia to defeat the Babylonians. Now, you remember, it was the Babylonians that had overtaken the Israelites. They were coming back from a Babylonian captivity. God had raised up the Persians to defeat the Babylonians. Now, at this time, the 70 years, you remember Jeremiah that I mentioned before? Jeremiah said that they would be in captivity for 70 years. And you can imagine, if you're sitting there thinking with an eye to what the prophet Jeremiah was saying, you go, hey, the 70 years might almost be up. And your anticipation would be coming that the day of freedom is not that far away. And so the people started to think, is it time for the messianic kingdom in Jerusalem? Now, God answers that he's going to fulfill the promise to them. But he leaves the timing of that fulfillment unanswered. See, the people are really focusing on when this is going to happen. What God is primarily trying to say is who I'm going to do it through. They're focused on when. God is really, in the visions, focusing on who. But you have the four horsemen that represents that God is overlooking everyone. And as a result, peace has come. The Babylonians have been defeated. The people are going to be brought back. This brings up the second vision and the seventh vision of Zechariah. Now, this is found in chapter 1, verses 18 to 21, but you can also find the seventh vision in chapter 5, verses 5 through 11. And these, of course, are paired together. In the second vision, there are horns, and the horns represent the University of Texas. I'm kidding. They don't. The horns represent the nations that attacked Israel. You need to be thinking of the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Egyptians and, of course, the Persians. However, the horns are then taken and they are scattered by what are called the blacksmiths. And the blacksmiths represents basically this is an image that God is going to defeat those that worked against the people of Israel. So you have those that defeated and depressed, and you have God making a promise, I'm going to defeat them. And then you have in the seventh vision, which is just a little bit weird, there's a woman in a basket. That's the vision. There's a woman in a basket. This was as near as I could come up with for you this morning. But here's the thing. The way that Zechariah unpacks this was you have this basket, and over the basket is a lead cover. And an angel opens the lid, and inside of the basket is the woman. And then what you find is the angel says this, "This is the sin of the people in the land." So what's in the basket represents the sin of the people in the land, and the angel covers it back up. And then what happens is you have other women with wings, now this is a vision, other women with wings come and they take the basket and they fly it back over to Babylon. And what the image this provides or what this symbolizes is that there is sin that is in there. It's almost like it's sin that is suppressed, but that they're going to be freed from. Just like the Babylonians had defeated them and held them in captivity, sin defeats us often. It holds us in captivity, but there is freedom, and it's coming. Which leads us to the third and the sixth visions, which are paired together. Imagine being oppressed for 70 years. Imagine being in captivity for 70 years. The idea of freedom would probably be very appealing to you, don't you think? And what you see in the third and the sixth visions as they are paired together is that these are visions about the rebuilding of a new Jerusalem. See, what we once had, we've lost, but now God is going to build something new. In the third vision, what you see is there's a man that is measuring the city. This is supposed to be an image of God's promise that it will be rebuilt and it will become a center for the nations to join God's people in worship. He's measuring the city out. It also represents that what God had once done in Jerusalem, he's going to be expanding out. And in the sixth vision, you see this scroll. And the scroll flies around Jerusalem, and it's punishing thieves and liars, just bad people, right? It's punishing them. And this symbolizes that the new Jerusalem is a place where people can see their sin through the law of God, and that they are purified from the sin that's in them. So on the one hand, you have this woman that's in a basket. When the lid is lifted up, it represents all of the sin that is in there, taken to a place where we see it's like captivity, ultimately, that God is going to free people from. And then in the center of all of these visions, you find the fourth and the fifth visions paired together. You can find these visions in chapter 3, verses 1 through 10, and chapter 4, verses 1 through 14. These visions are about two key leaders among the exiles. Joshua the high priest and a guy named Zerubbabel. And Zerubbabel, by the way, was a royal descendant of David. Now I just want to say this really fast. I was talking this morning with Debbie, who signs for me every week, and she came up to me and she goes, "There's a lot of Z's in the sermon this week." Zerubbabel. Why are these people so important? Well, if you look in the fourth vision, Joshua, the high priest, wears Israel's sin in the form of dirty clothes. In fact, if you look at Joshua, the image that is portrayed by Zechariah is that you have Joshua wearing these clothes and Satan is basically standing right next to him, accusing him and speaking against him. But what you see in the fourth vision is that those clothes which are dirty, this man that takes all of this on himself, those clothes which are filthy are taken off, and he's given new clothes. He's even given a turban, which is a symbol of God's grace and forgiveness. Joshua is then told that if he stays faithful, he'll lead his people and become a symbol of something even greater than himself. You just be faithful, and you will be a picture for the people of something greater than I'm going to do. And in the fifth vision, you get an idea of what this looks like. You have an olive tree. And the olive tree produces oil for the lamps, which is a symbol of God's watchful eye over all of his people. There are two trees, and the two trees represent the two leaders, Joshua and Zerubbabel, who are heading up the campaign to rebuild the temple. And they're told the rebuilding will only work if they depend on the Spirit of God. It's the only way it's going to work. You might have something in mind with regard to what it is that you want to build. But here's basically what the Lord is saying through the vision. Unless I'm the one building it through you, it's never going to happen. Unless I'm the one that is building it through you, this is never going to happen. At the end of all this, you get another vision. It's almost like the bonus vision, you know? In Louisiana, you would get a little something extra they would talk about, right? And you find this in chapter 6, verses 9 through 15, a final vision. Joshua, who is the high priest, is given a crown. This is a symbol of a future king that will only be fulfilled if his generation actually follows God. Israel has had a hard time following God, haven't they? And so here what you have is God speaking out to the people, saying, there's something that I want to do, but you need to follow me. And then in chapters 7 and 8, if I could just condense this down, you have the conclusion of all of the dreams. A small group of people come to Zechariah. Remember, Zechariah is totally aware of everything that's happening. He's not asleep over in a corner. He's having visions. It's like real world just in front of him. It's like he's in a different dimension, so to speak. He sees all of this. He's communicating all of this. And a small group comes up to Zechariah. And they come to him and they ask if they should stop grieving. Remember, they've been oppressed. They've been under captivity. And they said, should we stop grieving? Is God's kingdom actually coming soon for us? And Zechariah, in chapter 8, verses 1 through 17, he stops and he thinks with them for a little bit. Well, let me ask you a question. Have you pursued peace? Have you pursued justice? Have you loved people that are hard to love? Have you loved God more than yourself? Have you pursued him more than yourself? Notice what Zechariah is doing. He's flipping the question back onto the people. And he asked them, are you ready to be a people that will participate in what God's kingdom looks like? Are you ready for that? Are you ready to be a people that will participate in what God wants his kingdom to look like? And you said, at this point, this is the perfect time to answer, right? Great time to answer. And they don't answer. And the book just moves on. So if this whole series is unforetold, how it is that you see Jesus in these books of the Old Testament, where is Jesus in all of this? Oh, where is he? And I want to show you. Jesus is the branch of David. You see this in Zechariah chapter 6, verse 12. You are to tell him, this is what the Lord of armies says. Here is a man whose name is Branch, literally sprout. He will branch out from his place, and he will build the Lord's temple. Most Old Testament scholars would say that this is a direct reference to Jesus himself, who, being an heir of David, the kingly line, would raise up, would literally sprout out, and he would bring something to the earth that the earth had never seen before. It's also said in Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9, that this guy would show up at a time in Jerusalem. All of this stuff is about Jerusalem, right? We need to go back to Jerusalem. We need to build the temple back in Jerusalem. And that he would show up one day, and as he would show up, he would enter on a donkey. Does this remind you of something? Like in Matthew chapter 21, Jesus shows up at a time when the Israelites are hoping that they could be delivered from Rome. Just like when you look at Zechariah, it's like we wanted to be delivered from Babylon. Notice the things that they want to be delivered from. They want to be delivered from people that aren't kind to them. Deliver us from the Babylonians. Deliver us from the Egyptians. Deliver us from the Persians. Deliver us from the Romans. And then Jesus comes in, and he's riding on a donkey. And you go, what is that supposed to symbolize? And the answer is, this is a symbol of arriving in peace. He's coming to usher in a time of peace when you think about it. They want deliverance from political oppression. Jesus says, I'm trying to deliver you from something worse. This is what it says in Zechariah 9:9, shout, daughter Jerusalem, see your king comes to you, righteous and victorious, lowly and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. Now, what's amazing about all of this is that all of this was coming about 500 years before Jesus shows up. And Zechariah says, God's doing something now, but he's going to do something better later. Ultimately, what happens to Jesus? Zechariah tells you he's going to be betrayed. In Zechariah chapter 11, verse 12, it says, and I tell them, if you think it best, give me my pay, but if not, keep it. So they paid me 30 pieces of silver. Does that strike accord with any of you? You probably remember at the time, it's Jesus was had been going through his earthly ministry. He had performed a lot of miracles. He knew as he took the disciples into the upper room, he's looking his suffering in the face. He says, one of you is going to betray me. You remember that? One of you is going to deny me. One of you is going to betray me. And he's ultimately given over for 30 pieces of silver, which was basically the wage of a slave. And here you have in Zechariah chapter 11, over 500 years before the event unfolds, a narrative telling you what was going to happen. It even tells you the way that the story of Jesus' life is going to end. And you see it in Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10, because he's going to be crucified. And I will pour out on the house of David. Remember, he is the sprout of David. And I will pour out on the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and supplication. They will look on me, the one they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only child and grieve bitterly for him as one grieves for a firstborn son. So where is Jesus in all of this? I think Jesus shows us a couple of things. I think Zechariah shows us a couple of things. One of the things that Zechariah shows us is this. The same kinds of things that the Israelites want to be delivered from are the same kinds of things that we ask God to deliver us from. Maybe we missed the point of the whole story. I mean, what if the problem isn't Babylon? What if the problem aren't the Egyptians? What if the problem isn't the Persians? What if the problem isn't the Romans? What if the problem is something deeper? What if the problem is that we desire the wrong things? What if that's the problem? What if the problem is that we desire the wrong things? What if the problem is that we pursue the wrong things? What if the problem is that we ask God to deliver us from the wrong things? Just get me away from the Romans. Just get me away from the Babylonians. But we don't ask God to deliver us from what it is that really holds us captive. And it's that we desire the wrong things. C.S. Lewis, one of my favorite thinkers, said this: the Christian doesn't think that God will love us because we're good, but that God will make us good because he loves us. Let me say it again. The Christian doesn't think that God will love us because we're good, but that God will make us good because he loves us. You remember Scrooge? When he was getting to the end of his third vision, he had just hung out with the Ghost of Christmas Future, that great guy. Scrooge was asking the question because he saw a lot of things that were really troubling, and it was finally getting to him. You remember? And he asked this question: are these the things that must be? Are these the things that must be? And the reason they asked the question is because he's getting an eye toward the future. And he's looking at the Spirit, and he's saying to the Spirit, or can things be different? And of course, many of you have already seen the story, right? Because the things can be different if what? If Scrooge himself changes. Friends, it is absolutely no different for us. For some of us, we have to quit calling out to be delivered from the wrong thing and to call out to God and say, to deliver me from what's really holding me captive. I don't know what that is for you. Here's what I do know, is that the problem of sin is universal. And what it is that afflicts me may not be the same thing that afflicts you. But we need to call out in a spirit of humility to Jesus this Christmas season and to say, I want you to deliver me from what it is that's really keeping me from you. So what are you crying out to God for? I want you to remember the promise today. The promise that's seen in the book of Zechariah. The promise that's seen in the life of Jesus. Friends, he didn't die on the cross so that you can have necessarily health and wealth. That wasn't it. I mean, if that's the case, he failed his own test by every measure, because Jesus is described as a man that didn't have a place to lay his own head. He came to deliver us from something. He saw the root of the problem and said, I'm going to that. And he did it for me. He wants to do it for you. all who call upon the name of the Lord will be saved. That's what we've prayed for you this week, is that you would see Jesus this Christmas season in ways that you've never seen him before, love him more deeply, and you would be changed.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.